Well, we just finished our series on virtue, and now we're going to get into some other things that are certainly going to be using virtue and the series as a springboard. I want to start out by making perhaps what might be a startling admission, and that is that all Christians who are honest anyway struggle with their faith. It doesn't matter how many years you've been a Christian. I've been a Christian for a long time. I still struggle with faith, still struggle with the idea of faith. I'm not saying everyone struggles with faith in the same way or that we all have the same struggle with faith. For example, one might struggle with the idea of evil in the world and maybe hell as a punishment for evil people. Another person might struggle with forgiveness and what they're being asked to do. Another person might struggle with the Holy Spirit. How does he work? What does he do? How do we know? Or someone might struggle with the trials that they're facing. Why am I going through this? What is God's plan for me? What am I supposed to learn? What am I supposed to do by faith? The thing to remember here is that faith is based on facts, evidence, and divine revelation. But it's still faith, a personal conviction in things hoped for, an assurance of things not seen, things that are invisible to us. Evidence-based faith, rather, has good reason to exist, but the existence of faith itself always comes down to a personal decision. It's not a natural law. Just because the evidence is there doesn't mean someone's automatically going to have faith. Gravity is a natural law. Gravity is there and will work whether you believe in it or not. I can test this by jumping off a cliff or falling out of a tree. You know, whether I believe I would or didn't doesn't really change the fact. But faith doesn't work that way. Faith does not exist if you don't believe, even though the evidence for that belief is there. Even though all the evidence, all the foundation is there for it, still it takes a personal decision. So one thing is common in faith to all people. Until we have seen what we put our faith in, it remains faith and not absolute fact to that person. For example, I don't have faith that Bibles exist because I have one sitting right here in front of me. But I do have to have faith that God exists because I have not seen him. I believe I will see him, and at that time I will no longer have faith in him, but it will be an absolute fact to me. But until that time, I preach him as though he is fact because I have every reason to believe that, but I have not seen him in fact. I preach him, in fact, because of the evidence that he's given to me, but I personally have faith in that existence. I hope I make myself clear here in understanding what really faith is. But suppose you could ask God for increased faith, a deeper faith, stronger faith, more enlightened faith than what you have now. First of all, the question is, would you do it without fear of where that faith and that increased faith would take you? Or secondly, would God give it to you? Or thirdly, is this even possible? You know, the Bible teaches that each person makes his own decisions about what he or she wants to believe, what he or she wants to believe in, and to what extent that person wants to believe. The question is, does God get actively involved in that process? In Luke 17, verse 5, we have the 12 apostles here that say to Jesus, increase our faith. This is a unique request in the Gospels. Interestingly, Jesus does not say, sure, here you go, boom, you know, and immediately they all have increased faith. But he doesn't also say, no, that's a dumb question. What he does say is recorded here in verse 6. He says, if you had faith like a mustard seed, you would say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. That's his response to that question, which is an interesting response, and it's going to take us a good half the lesson to explain that, okay? It's an intriguing response, and yet the question remains, can Jesus increase faith? And did he increase those disciples' faith? What about my faith or your faith? Can we ask him to do that? Can your or my faith actually uproot trees and toss them into the sea? In Matthew 17, verse 20, he gives a parallel verse there. He says, if you had faith like a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, you know, be uprooted and cast into the sea. Not just a tree, but an entire mountain. Imagine if you could say to Mount Rainier, be uprooted and cast into the sea, and it would obey you. Imagine that kind of faith or that kind of power. Was this something only for the apostles? Did Jesus mean miraculously assisted faith, or is the purpose of faith only to do miracles? Might be the question there. And what about this mustard seed thing? If such small faith can uproot trees, but my faith cannot, then is my faith really so small that it can't do anything? Or is Jesus saying here, all mustard seed-sized faith must be able to accomplish great things such as that? Well, whatever Jesus said here in this passage, Luke 17, verse 1 through 10, certainly is worthy of our attention, and I'll do what I can in the time that I have allotted. It starts off, verse 1 and 2, Luke 17, verse 1 and 2, Jesus warns his disciples not to become a stumbling block. He says, stumbling blocks are going to happen. They're inevitable, but don't be one yourself. A stumbling block is a snare, a trap, or a cause for tripping. You might have seen the old pictures of a stick, you know, with a big box there, you know, trying to trap an animal. And when that stick gets pulled out, the box falls down. Well, that stumbling block would be whatever causes that stick to fall down, whatever traps that animal, trips it up there to get trapped. Jesus condemns in graphic terms anyone who would purposely, maliciously, or carelessly lead another person away from the Lord and into moral error. In fact, he says, an awful physical death of having a heavy stone tied around your neck and thrown into the sea would be preferable to what awaits you in the hereafter for doing such a thing. In Luke 17, verse 3 and 4, Jesus also warns, don't let another man's sin become your stumbling block. In other words, the fact that he has sinned against you, or however many times he's sinned against you, don't let that to be a cause of you becoming resentful or bitter or cynical toward that brother. If your brother sins, he says, well, then call him out and rebuke him. And by the way, we need to take that seriously. We can't just sit back and watch our brothers or sisters sinning and not say anything. We're told, we're commanded to call them out and say something. But he also says, if your brother repents, well, then you're to forgive him. Which means to me, as I understand this here, forgiveness demands repentance. And thus, forgiveness is conditional. We spent a whole series talking about this last spring, but here's a verse that succinctly says it right there. If anything is required in order for forgiveness to be given, then forgiveness is conditional and not freely given for no reason at all. And then he says, if your brother sins or repents and begs forgiveness seven times in one day, we assume, obviously, not the same sin, because that's not repentance, but seven different sins in one day, you are to forgive him. So now I learn that forgiveness not only requires repentance, but it also has to be requested. It's not something that is to be assumed. It's not something to be given automatically or assumed to be given automatically. The responsibility of the sinner is to ask the one whom he sinned against for his forgiveness, whether that be God or your fellow man. So there's some things that Jesus lays out here, and they're difficult things here. And on the heels of these two instructions, the disciples say, increase our faith, which may well imply that these instructions are, first of all, very unnerving. Anything having to do with a stumbling block and, you know, and the horrible fate that awaits such a person, that's a very unnerving thing, or something that is very difficult, like forgiving people who sin against us, those who offend us, and basically may be saying, we need more faith. We need more faith to deal with these difficult instructions, these difficult things that you are laying upon us. And the request may also be due to the fact that in several cases, Jesus had called out their little faith. Remember the sea on the and the storm on the sea there, and the disciples are in the boat with Jesus, and they're thinking that the boat's going to sink and wake Jesus up. Master, save us. And he says to them, basically, you have little faith. Do you really think this boat's going to capsize and you're all going to drown when I'm with you? Where's your faith? So he's called them out on this before, and so maybe they're saying, well, you know, here's the master. Obviously, we have little faith. But a possible implication here is saying, since our faith is so little and your expectations are so great, then you increase it. It's really your job, Jesus, to increase our faith. In a sense, trying to make Jesus responsible for their faith, the quantity of it, the quality of it. And I do wonder sometimes if we don't do that, consciously or not, like put the burden on God, like, God, you've got all these things you're asking me to do. It's really up to you to prepare me in such a way so as to do them. So I'm waiting for you to prepare me. Increase my faith. But in any case, Jesus does not accept responsibility for their personal faith. And I think that is a really important point to walk away with from this lesson. He doesn't accept responsibility for anyone's personal faith. Not theirs, not anyone's, not yours, not mine. Jesus says in 17 verse 6 again, that if you had faith small as a mustard seed, you would say this mulberry tree, be uprooted, cast into the sea. Mulberry trees are known for their deep, penetrating root systems. And yet genuine followers of Christ ought to be known for their deep, penetrating faith. Jesus does not use arbitrary object lessons, by the way. He chooses his objects very carefully and intentionally. God provides then the context in which that tree grows, the soil, the water, the climate, the place. Likewise, he provides the context in which human faith grows, necessary evidence, teaching, a model example, positive peer pressure, even trials and testing. So God causes the growth by providing a goal to strive for. He provides the growth by tools necessary to reach that goal and the teaching and instruction to learn all these things in the first place. But he doesn't do all the work while we sit back and watch. So Jesus is saying, in essence, I will provide you with whatever you need for increased faith. But you're going to have to do your part in that increase yourself. And that's what we've been saying all along with regard to salvation. There's God's part and there's your part. God does what you can't do, but you and I are expected to do what we are able to do and expected to do. God's part is called grace. All the things he does for us that we can't do falls into that package of grace. And everything that we do in response to his word, in obedience to his commandments, in fulfilling those expectations he has for us that we can do, that is called faith. So Jesus is saying, in essence, I'm going to do what I do as God, but you're going to have to do what you do as a human follower of Christ. And it seems to me, in my understanding here, it seems the disciples might be concerned that their smallness of faith cannot do anything at all, which might imply that only big faith, or maybe really big faith, is possible to do or is able to do anything. I do wonder about that about ourselves, too. You know, we might look at someone who has more faith than us and think, well, they can do all kinds of things, but me, you know, my faith's small, and perhaps underdeveloped at the time. And it might be reason for that. Maybe you're a new Christian. Maybe you've gone through a lot of trial. Maybe you just haven't had time and experience yet to nurture that faith there. Or it could be a negative thing. Maybe you just haven't worked on it. Maybe you just haven't made the application there. Jesus says that a mustard seed-sized faith can do great things. A mustard seed is the size of a poppy seed or coriander seed. Some of you feel compelled to bring coriander seed to our house. And you know, those of you know what I'm talking about. We have like 13 jars now of coriander seed that people keep bringing to our house. Actually, it's two, but it feels like a lot. I think we can actually coriander seed the world for a long time with what we have. But it's a very small thing. Poppy seed might be more familiar to you. You know, like a poppy seed muffin. Take one of those little seeds, those black things off that, like the size of a dot there, right? And just think about that. That's what Jesus is talking about. If you had faith that small, you could say to this tree, be uprooted. Think about that. Faith that small, even that faith, that size, is sufficient to accomplish great things. And if that's true, then imagine what great faith can accomplish. Jesus does not say, however, be content with small faith. Since you can do great things with small faith, therefore just be content with that. He never said that. He never dissuaded anyone from pursuing great faith. In fact, we're told in Scripture to have great faith or greater faith all the time. 2 Peter 5, chapter 1, verse 5 through 7, he talks there about adding to our faith so that it can grow, and it should grow. It's supposed to grow and be added to. Colossians 2, verse 6 and 7, Paul says that you are to be built up and firmly established in your faith. Well, in order to endure or to weather the storms of life and the struggles that you face. So there, we have plenty, and this is just a small sample, we have plenty of things we could cite that say that our faith is supposed to increase, it's supposed to grow, it's naturally expected to grow. just like a tree itself is naturally expected to grow. But Jesus is saying you don't have to wait until then to do what needs to get done. Don't wait until you have this big, huge faith in order to do what you're able to do, even with small faith or little faith. He's also saying, and this is kind of the underlying premise here, if you understood the dynamics of faith in God, then you could see and understand how to increase it, which is really what this lesson is all about. If we understood the dynamics of faith itself, then we would automatically recognize the way in which it is increased. Suppose someone says, well, my faith has never uprooted trees or moved mountains, so it must be smaller than a mustard seed. And thinking that way really misses Jesus' point because it misunderstands his teaching and the purpose for it. The source of strength to uproot trees and move mountains is not in the faith itself. I don't want you to think that God imparts to you this great strength to do things and now you're going to exercise this strength on your own terms or in your own way or on your own time. Faith is a catalyst. It's not the source of strength. Recently, Mike and I we put a couple of fence posts in the ground, and we secured those posts with concrete. Interesting thing about concrete is that if you just pour concrete mix into a hole with a fence post, it's just a bunch of dust and rock, okay? Or at least that's what it appears, and it's not going to do anything. But if you add water to that concrete, mix it up, and then pour it in the hole, it firms up pretty solid to where you can't move it anymore once it dries or cures. Okay? So here we have the concrete plus a catalyst, which is water, and that provides a necessary result, something effective, something functional, something that was more than what you started with. The strength is not in the water, it's in the mix. If we just poured water in the hole for the fence post, well, we just have a big wet hole, okay? And we wouldn't have a fence worth talking about. But as it is, when we put that water together with the source of strength, then everything comes together. I want you to see faith in that very same way. Now, faith is the catalyst. It's not the source of strength in itself. The source of strength or the substance is really in God's power. But God's power, for ourselves, that is, demands a catalyst, something to do on our part. No one's faith is strong enough by itself to uproot a tree or move a mountain. But God's strength is strong enough, and it can do that if that's what he wants to do. He can perform in ways that we cannot. So sometimes we're focusing on the wrong part of the equation. God is the mix. We are the water, or our faith is the water, if you will. We need to understand that, not because I say so, but because that's what Jesus is teaching here. We need to understand the role that our faith plays here in getting things done. So if you didn't add water to this concrete mix, then it would remain just a bag full of dust and stones, like I said. And if you don't apply faith to your situation, to your life, to the ministry God has given to you, well, it's just not going to perform as it was intended. That's where your faith comes in. We are told in Ephesians 6, verse 10, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. It's not your strength, it's not your might to focus on, but rather God's. Your job, my job, is to put our faith in a strong and mighty God. His job is to exercise that strength and that might to bring about your salvation. So just simply putting everything in the context and understanding where everything is supposed to be. What role does my faith play? What role does God's grace and power play? In what context is this to be used and so on? Even small faith then can accomplish great things because that small faith doesn't rely on its own strength to do it. It implies divine strength, something outside of itself. Prayer, by the way, works in very much the same way. Your prayer is very small compared to God's ability to fulfill it. But God waits for you to pray to him before he responds to that prayer. He doesn't just answer prayers that are never asked. He wants you to pray to him. It's not that he doesn't know. It's not that he isn't capable of doing what you're asking. He knows what you need before you even ask him. Jesus said that. Read Matthew 6. He tells you that straight up. It's not that you need to inform God, but it is a necessary act of faith in God. So that's what prayer is. It's an act of faith. You demonstrate your faith in this very powerful, mighty God, and then that God of power and might acts in such a way that fulfills that prayer in essence. Not exactly how you might have asked it, but in the way that is in your best interest. And it takes faith to pray that way. We are saved the same way. Ephesians 2, verse 8 says that we are saved by grace through faith. God is not giving me grace to save myself, like he's zapping me with a bunch of grace, and all of a sudden I've got grace to save myself. He is the power of my salvation. He is the source of the strength that it takes to save me. But I have to exercise faith in him in order for that power to be exercised on my behalf. And without my faith, even though God has all that power still in reserve, so to speak, still there with full potential to save me, even though he has all that power, without my faith, he will not save me, nor will he save you. So how important is faith? Well, no one is saved without it. We walk by faith, not by sight. We live by faith. And so we understand that faith is absolutely critical, but we do need to know its place, if you will. But Jesus takes it actually one step further in Luke 17, verse 7 through 10. He talks about this servant going out to work and then coming in, and instead of the master saying, "Oh, you've been working all day, well, sit down and eat. I mean, after all, you must be famished and tired." He says, "Fix me a meal, and then after I've eaten and drunk, then you can sit down and have your own meal." In other words, you're a servant. This is what servants do. And so there's something very interesting. He shows the other side of it. We need to remember who we are when we exercise our faith and who we are not. Masters do not serve slaves, but slaves serve masters. Masters do not obey slaves, but slaves obey masters. The master does not become a slave to his slaves, but it is the slave's job to fulfill the duty of a slave, because that's what he is. He is a slave. And so if we're going to be slaves to God, servants to God, if you will, those who follow Christ, if that's the role that we're accepting when we are baptized, which we did accept, by the way, then we need to understand that we're never going to get outside of that role, that we're never going to become the master, that we're never going to take the place of the master. We're never going to rise up to the level of the master and start telling the master, "Okay, I need a pat on the back here, or you know, some kind of commendation, or some kind of special privilege," because we have to remember who we are. A faithful servant will strive to fulfill every commandment of his master. He will put his master's will and request ahead of his own. He will serve his master first as a priority, not himself. This is how it should be. This is how it has always been when it's done rightly, and this is how it is in the kingdom of God. Jesus is our master. We are his slaves. We do not expect him to serve us, but we do expect to serve him, and so does he. So I think Jesus is just putting all this in perspective. Yeah, you're going to have increased faith when you do what is required for that increase, but don't think that when you have that increase and you do great things with that faith, even if it were to uproot trees and move mountains, even if you were to do that, don't go thinking that suddenly you have risen above your slave status and now have ascended into the rank of master, because you haven't. When we exercise faith in the master and for the master, and great things are accomplished as a result, we have no reason to congratulate ourselves, because it is the master who still feeds us and takes care of us. Likewise, we have no reason to expect special treatment, or, as I said, a pat on the back for what we've done, because we're only doing what we're told to do in the first place. In fact, honestly, we're unable to do anything more than that. We're unable to do anything more than just what slaves do, which is really what Jesus is getting at here in verse 10. When you do all the things which are commanded, say, "We're unworthy slaves. We have only done that which we ought to have done." We didn't exceed that which we ought to have done. We didn't go beyond that. Even when we met that perfectly, we still did only that which we were commanded to do. We didn't go beyond that and say, "Well, God, I know you commanded this of me, but I'm going to go one step further and do something that you never expected me to do." We just can't do that. Now, don't think unworthy there in that passage means useless or worthless. It means undeserving or not deserving other than what slaves deserve. Because that's, again, what we are. What do we do with all this, this information here? This ought to be extremely helpful, and I think it is on several levels. First of all, positively, we are giving some challenging things to do, like forgiving people is a challenging thing to do. Negatively, we are warned against using what we know in a bad way, like using it as a stumbling block, taking advantage of weak or untrained or inexperienced people, leading them into moral error through our poor example or more particularly, our poor instruction or inciting them to be tempted beyond their ability to resist that. You and I need to take that very seriously because it is very serious. And you and I need to take that very personally because Jesus is speaking to you and I. So, in the opening verses there, verse 1 through 2 of chapter 17, he's saying, well, you need to take this serious about what I'm saying. And then 3 and 4, you need to take that serious as well. Don't be a stumbling block and be a forgiving person. Secondly, it's not the size of our faith that matters because God can do great things even with small faith. What it appears to me that God is looking for is the quality of faith and the authenticity of our faith. Why does your faith exist? Does it exist? What is your faith in? Who is your faith in? What is your faith willing to endure? And most importantly, is your faith real? Is it authentic? And then that begs the question, well, then how big is your faith compared to mine, et cetera? But that's not really the question. The question is, do we have faith that God can use? And what are you doing to increase that faith? Remember, faith is intensely personal. If we don't believe, then it doesn't exist, even though the evidence is there for it to exist. See, a person cannot sit on a church pew and say, increase my faith, because that's just not going to happen. I do wonder sometimes, having watched people for a long time as a Christian in church services and otherwise, maybe wanting to hold some preacher or the preaching or elders or the congregation responsible for their faith. As in to say, it's your job to increase my faith. I showed up, now, increase my faith. I'm here, so, infuse me with whatever it is that I need. And it's really not my responsibility to do that. Jesus didn't accept responsibility for your faith or mine, so I'm not going to accept responsibility for your faith either. Your faith is your faith. My faith is my faith. I have a responsibility to increase my faith, and I need to do it in the way that God has said to. And God's going to do whatever I cannot do in that process, but you have that same responsibility to do that with your faith. Your faith is your responsibility, not anyone else's, not mine, not this church's, not anyone else's. And if you really want to increase your faith, then you have to do what it takes to increase it. You have to put your faith to work. You have to exercise it daily in prayer and study. You need to gain knowledge and encouragement through fellowship with the saints. You need to call or visit those whose faith is being sorely tested. You need to study with those who are weak or study with those who are unbelievers. In other words, you just need to do something that God is expecting you and telling you to do. You can't sit there and go, increase my faith, and not do the very things that it takes to have your faith increased. That's like saying, to an instructor at the gym, increase my muscles, increase my stamina, increase my strength, and you just sit there eating a banana or, a granola bar or something. I mean, you just can't do that. You got to get on the weight bench, and you got to do some running, and you got to do some training. That will increase your faith. The instructor is there to teach you how and give you those steps and so on, but you've got to do the work. And so here we are. You've got to do the work. I have noticed for over 30 years, it seems to me that always the weak members are those who think they don't need all these things that I just mentioned. They don't think they need all those things. They just think, apparently, that you're going to get strong by showing up to church services over its course of time, and then after about 10 years or so, you get vested, like retirement, right? And then you just suddenly, now it's due you. You're entitled to go into heaven because you've been here for so long. Strong members, however, I've noticed, know better, and they are busy doing the things that I just mentioned. That's why they're strong, and that's how they got to be strong in the first place. So you could choose to be weak. Remember, we just had a class on that. You can choose to be weak, or you can choose to be strong. You can choose to have increased faith, or you can choose to have a faith that is constantly whittling down into virtually nothing at all. That's your choice. I'm not saying that in a careless way here, like I don't care about what you choose. I do care, but the fact remains, it is your choice, and I can't change that for you. You can't change that for me. If you are resisting the prescription, if we can call it that, for stronger and deeper faith, if you're resisting that, constantly stiff-arming that, God says do this, the preacher says do this, strong members say do this, and you're like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't think I have to do that. Maybe that worked for you, but it's not going to work for me. If you're the one constantly stiff-arming all the advice and the instruction, you ought not to be surprised that your faith stays very weak. Should be no surprise to you. Because it won't be any surprise to me, because you've chosen that course by your action. I see also, and I'm guilty of this as much as anyone else, that we tend to shy away from the very challenges that would increase our faith. We tend to want to remain sheltered, insulated, sometimes isolated, and very much protected. But our faith does not grow and cannot become stronger if that's what we always choose. It just doesn't work that way. You know that research has shown that children who stay inside all the time, do not get dirty, do not get outside of a single environment, they also do not build up immunity to germs and bacteria. An interesting thing about the body is that your immune system needs to be challenged. It needs to be tested in order for it to work properly. Just think about that. It needs to be tested. You need to be confronted with all the stuff that's out there. I understand some of that will kill you, but stay away from that. But the point is, I mean, just through the normal course of the day, I mean, you need to be confronted with the real world, with real life. And if you're not going to, if you're going to stay holed up in a cave or in your bedroom or in your living room or in your den or whatever it is that you hole up in, if that's where you're going to spend all your time, you should not be surprised that your immune system becomes very weak. And then when you are confronted with those other things, immediately it's attacked and overwhelmed. And your faith works very much the same way. If you're just holing up in a church building or holing up in your house or holing up in your own circle of friends that all seem to agree with you all the time and believe everything you do and, you know, cheer you on for every decision you make, if that's what you hole up in, then it's no surprise that when you suddenly get outside that group all of a sudden and someone confronts you or challenges your faith, you don't know what to do because your faith has not been tested. You need to get out in the real world. You need to have your faith tested. Here's another example that goes along with it. The older generation here is slipping away, and the newer generation needs to step up. We have been saying this for years, actually for decades, because it's been happening on and over. The newer generation needs to step up. Here's what I get from the newer generations, not just any one particular, but the newer generations is, I'm not comfortable doing some of those things. I'm not comfortable in that role. I'm not just talking about things like in the worship service, but just I'm not comfortable stepping into that role. I'm not comfortable. How is your faith going to increase if you're always going to stay in your comfort zone? Do you recognize that faith doesn't have a comfort zone? There is no such thing as comfort zone in the New Testament. Not defined, not advocated, not instructed, not supported, not approved. There's nothing about comfort zone in the New Testament. There says a lot about faith, however, and how faith needs to be entered into and exercised and so forth. Your faith does not have a comfort zone. You need to start thinking differently. Younger generations, myself included, we have to step into these roles. Otherwise, the church as we know it is not going to exist in the future. And that is unacceptable. And we will be part of the reason for that. And that is unacceptable. I hope that's unacceptable to you. So forget about your comfort zone. I don't mean to say that I'm unaware of your level of faith as it might be right now. For example, if you've just been baptized, I don't expect you to get up here and preach a lesson or suddenly make major decisions for this congregation. I don't expect that. But at the same time, sometimes baby steps, I keep hearing people saying, well, baby steps. Yeah, sometimes people drag out baby steps over like 10 or 15 or 20 years. How long has your child been a baby? I mean, you have to recognize that sometime, baby steps need to turn into, adult steps. And we need to get out of that baby step mode. There's a time for baby steps. There's a time for learning and preparation. There's also a time for just simply doing what needs to get done because you know it's the right thing to do. Remember our lessons on virtue there. And here's another lesson for us that can be extracted from what Jesus said. Those who have endured, those who have accomplished great things, those who have converted many souls, those who have been a pillar in the church for a number of years, do not think that Christ owes you anything more than what he promised you on your baptism and what you agreed to at that same time. Do not think that you get some special merit now, that you get a special pat on the back, that Christ is going to have to give you more reward because you have shown great faith. Christ is still the master. You are still the servant. You are simply doing what you should have done all along. Now, when I say that, it sounds kind of harsh because it makes it sound like I'm not recognizing such people for what they've done. That's not what I mean whatsoever. I don't think that's what Christ means at all. What I'm saying here, what I understand Christ to be saying is don't get cocky and arrogant and thinking that just because you've exercised great faith, now that somehow you've risen up a several levels toward the master, you are still a servant. And there's nothing wrong with being a servant. Servants will be praised in the hereafter. For being good servants. Enter in, good and faithful servant. That's a good thing, but you've got to fulfill the role of a servant first. And not think that somehow you rise above that. Pride goes before a fall. We shouldn't forget that. Pride does tend to get in the way. As you see on the screen, don't let your accomplishments go to your head. I get so tired of church signs that say, God says your faith can move mountains. There's one I passed by here over here somewhere, on the way to my house, and there's this sign that says that in so many words. Your faith can move mountains. That's just misleading. And it puts the wrong emphasis on faith itself. If Christ needs you to uproot a tree or move a mountain, you have to believe that it can be done. If that's what he wants. But if he doesn't need that to be done, then it's useless for you to try to do something that he didn't ask you to do, is what I mean there. Okay? Many have tried to do that. I've seen people do this in the past. Say, I've got great faith, and I'm going to go out and do all this stuff, and I'm going to move mountains and uproot trees, and then that doesn't happen, and then they get all discouraged. Like, oh, I guess God doesn't care about me. Here's a point you might have thought about, that maybe you just haven't learned what the will of the Lord is. That he didn't need you to do all that stuff in the first place. You just took it upon yourself. You need to learn what the will of the Lord is. We're told that explicitly in Ephesians 5. Learn what the will of the Lord is, and then use your faith accordingly. Also, you and I cannot be saving our faith for something great in the future when there's plenty to do right now. Simple expressions of faith, prayer, study, fellowship, as I mentioned, serving one another, expressions of godly love, these are needed right now. Suppose you had a pantry full of food and there's people all around you who are starving, and you've got all this food and you keep saying to yourself, you know what, someday there's going to be a great natural catastrophe and when that happens, I'll be ready, I'll be able to feed people. Well, actually, you need to feed people right now. Because we have a need. We don't have to wait until some calamity strikes or some big event happens. We have things that need to be done right now. Someone might be here thinking or being even praying, increase my faith. The idea itself is not bad because you should want increased faith. But the means to increased faith is to be busy doing what the Master commanded you to do in the first place. And trusting his grace to do what you can't. That's really what it comes down to. Do what you're supposed to do, what you're told to do, and trusting God to do what you can't do. He has told us what to do to have increased faith, stronger faith, deeper faith. We can't ignore all that and then make him responsible for what we have been commanded to do. He will not take that responsibility for us or from us. On the other hand, Christ is looking for faithful men and women to carry out his will. And the faith of those who do step up, their faith will be increased. God will be the source of that increase, since he's the one who provides everything necessary for that faith to grow. So the question comes down to, what kind of faith do you have? What are you doing to increase that faith? And is the increase of your faith even on your mind? Is that even what you're thinking about? Or are you just happy with what you have and you're content with that? Or are you focusing on other things, always lesser things, inferior things? Is this my job to increase your faith? Or is that your job to increase your faith? The question is not, does Christ want your faith to increase? That's not the question, because that's obvious, he does. The question is, really, what do you want? Because that's always what the question ends up being. What do you want? For yourself, for God, what do you want? That's our lesson this morning. If there's anyone here who has been pricked in their conscience, perhaps, or motivated in some way to seek a deeper increased faith, well, then this lesson has met its objective. Now, hopefully we've been educated on some things, at least an expositional education on this passage in Luke. But maybe there's someone here, like Tom prayed in his prayer, that has been thinking about becoming a Christian, and they know now what they need to do. If your resolve is to become a Christian, then what's stopping you this morning? Do what you need to do. Be baptized.